Hello, this is Chaz from Quiet Speculation, and you're listening to the QS Cast. If you're a QS subscriber, you're hearing this as soon as it gets published. If you're not a subscriber, you had to wait a few days. If you want to listen to the podcast as soon as it's published, or you just want to know more about Quiet Speculation, go to quietspeculation.com/tour and check out everything we have to offer. Hey folks, welcome back to the QS Cast for another vendor series. We're having in Mark from Mythic MTG, so thank you for giving us your time, Mark. Glad to have you.
It's my pleasure to be here.
It's always awesome. So we're kind of wrapping things up for this round of vendor series with Mark, saving the best for last year. Tarkan's also joining us. What's up, Tark?
Chaz, what's going on? Mark, thanks so much for coming on board. It's going to be awesome to chat with you.
Again, it's my pleasure.
Yep. Yeah, why don't we just, you know, open things up with, just a intro to Mythic MTG, kind of how you all started and your growth in the merchant space.
Sure. And if I get long-winded, just cut me off. Our retail store, called Fantasy Games, has been open in South Bend, Indiana for about 22 years. And over the years, we tried various things to try to get online. And in late 2009, 2010, we decided to launch Mythic with a separate identity from our local store. The idea being that when people say Fantasy Games in South Bend, we're kind of in no man's land. So we didn't necessarily want to push our local brand in the market. So we chose an alternate name that we could try to go nationwide with. We just started out with vending at PTQs and kind of worked up to some bigger events, and we do Gen Con every year. I don't know, what else do you need to know?
So this is really fascinating to me, Mark, because so you started out as a brick and mortar in the early days, and then you've transitioned to online as well, as you know, you expanded that into a new component of your business. So I'm very curious to know, because, you know, as I mentioned before, we have a variety of people on here, and, you know, we have big guys like Card Kingdom, whatever, but you're a smaller operation. And I'm very, very curious because, you know, we have a lot of smaller LGS members of QS and people to listen. I'm curious, what is your perspective of Magic? What have you seen in the industry, how it's been from when it was 22, 25 years ago? As a small LGS to now, you operate still a local LGS, but then you have this online component. It's a very interesting perspective, because you got a guy like you have like people like ABU, and he started out of his basement. Now he's running ABU. You sort of stayed in this same lane of having doing the LGS thing and keeping that going, and you started in the early days, and you still have that, but now you have this online component. I'm just very curious, you know, what your view on the industry and how you've seen it, you know, develop and change as a vendor, over the past 23 years you've been in.
Sure. Well, I guess the biggest change that's happened is what I call moving closer to perfect information. You know, back in the early days, the internet was kind of in its infancy. So I think, let me think of the name of it. The Dojo was the big Magic content site, and prices were kind of, you know, paper scry magazines. So the big challenge early on was, you know, finding market price and deciding what cards were worth and trying to buy and sell with, you know, scry magazine being printed, and by the time it would hit the shelves was usually 6 weeks old. Today we have perfect information, which means pretty much everybody knows the lowest price you can buy a card for. And the people who buy lists, they know the highest price that they can sell the card for. And the more we move towards that perfect information, the slimmer that margin becomes. So it becomes increasingly difficult to operate an online business. So for our site, I discovered that our local customers were continuously asking for the online identity. My intention was originally when I set it up was to keep those separate. Fantasy Games and Mythic would be two separate companies that even though they occupied the same building, they would operate separately because some of the prices on Mythic might not be the same as the price we sell things for in the store. But as our customers, you know, would talk to the staff at the counter, they would catch wind that we had an online store as the staff was talking about pulling orders for Mythic or, you know, restocking the web store, and they would ask. And eventually we introduced Mythic with a pickup in-store component. And overnight, our in-store sales just kind of boomed as we discovered our customers want to put in an order on our website at 3 a.m. and then have it ready to be picked up on their lunch break when they swing by the store. It was that revelation that kind of got me off of the track of trying to become one of the big Grand Prix dealers and just focus on our local market. So ultimately, while I would never say no to Mythic becoming a big Grand Prix dealer, we've just found many better uses for our time and our efforts than to chase that type of a plan. And for us locally, the Mythic site has kind of really bloomed our local business into more than I could have ever imagined.
So this is really interesting. This is fairly unique then, I guess. And you had mentioned briefly when we were, you know, discussing having you on that you kind of operate a little differently than most vendors. And is this sort of tied into that kind of unique model where your online component exists primarily to serve your local customer base rather than try and just get as much reach as possible? You wanted to get as much reach as possible, but the intention for it is to more so serve the local base. Does that kind of tie into this sort of unique model that you have, or are there other components as well?
It does. And the analogy that I give people when I talk about this kind of stuff is like the stock market. When a person wants to grow up and be a stock trader, they don't trade every single stock that's available on the stock market. I mean, no one can keep up with that much information. They pick 6 or 8 or 10 stocks that interest them. They study those stocks only, and they only trade in those. If they catch wind that some other stock somewhere else is poised to jump or had a big surge, they don't really worry about it because they're just focused on their little portfolio of 10 that they like. So when I realized that, you know, to sell cards online, typically, as I said, as buy prices and sell prices come closer and closer together, I realized, do I want to spend $40 on a card that I'm going to hope to sell for maybe $48, or do I want to spend $4 on a card that I could sell for $10 or $11? And, you know, we just kind of focused on the sweet spot, we call it, is cards that cost between like $3 and $10, because that's what we sell at the local store level. And we don't really worry too much about things like dual lands because, you know, they're capital intense for a store to stock dual lands. And, you know, you just don't get very much when you flip those. It's kind of a, you know, from my perspective, there are better markets out there to buy and sell dual lands than what I'm able and willing to provide.
So with that in mind, can you tell us then when you say $4 to $10, that there's still kind of a range. Is that anything that's $4 to $10, or do you break it down even further and you focus on mostly casual, mostly standard, modern, or is it just pretty much anything that carries demand within $4 to $10?
Anything that carries demand in $4 to $10. We in our retail store we have a binder for every set that was ever printed, except for. I don't think we have Alpha, Beta, or Unlimited. We used to have those books, but those kind of just dried up, and we don't have those anymore. But every other set, we keep between 4 and 12 of every card in those binders. And the way our system works is, you know, cards are just widgets. When a card goes under the amount we want to keep in stock, it shows up on the buy list. And when it gets filled back up to where we want it to be, it goes off the buy list. And we are able to tailor our buy prices based on a price range. So hopefully if you go to our website, will be competitive in the buy prices for the cards in that $4 to $10 or $12 range. And I understand that we may not be competitive for some of the higher end staples for Legacy and stuff, but that's because we just choose not to trade in those areas.
Cool. I see. Now, I know, I mean, you guys are pretty, I've used your buy list. Actually, I've used your buy list several times. I've done a lot of business through it, and it's really good. The system's really easy. You're also, I've noticed, you're very, very fair. You guys are pretty, you know, some of the larger institutions, not to name any names, but, you know, some people think that they're a little bit strict when it comes to grading, but you guys tend to be fairly, you know, you guys are rather fair. And is that a product of being sort of, you know, because you do operate sort of I don't want to say a smaller level, but you're not dealing in massive amounts of volume and you don't have all kinds of return policies and you don't have to worry about lots of return volume. Is that sort of why you do it? Or is it simply just a business policy that you're like, listen, you know, we know there's a subjective component to all of this and we try and just be fair with it?
The first part is I personally grade all of the buy lists that get submitted through our website when they come through the mail. If people sell cards in our store, any one of our staff would handle those. But currently, I do all the grading for the stuff that comes through the mail. I want to say that we're liberal, but at the same time, I don't want to encourage people to take advantage of that. A couple of dings on a card here and there don't really upset me because we're selling those cards to our local players who just want to play with the card. We've kind of avoided the, you know, the hardcore, if this card isn't specifically 100% mint with no dings and no flaws whatsoever, we're going to ding the buy list price way down. You know, we just don't do that.
Listeners, that does not mean to start dumping your MP cards and HP cards onto Mark, please.
Yeah. You know, I mean, there are times that we get buy lists where I open these cards up and I look at them and I'm just like, there's no way I can accept these as, you know, our near mint price. And I, you know, our buy list system has a process to grade each individual card and make offers on that. But, you know, without naming names, you know, it is my opinion that some of those places that are super strict because the prices that they offer from time to time are top of the market. And, you know, sometimes they're trying to, once they have the cards in their hand, you know, a little ding here and there is something that most people will accept. You know, not saying that they do that on purpose, but if you're paying top dollar, they need absolute mint cards. We're able to, you know, overlook that and accept a lot of times cards that would be graded as slight play elsewhere, we just pay our near mint buy price for and move on to the next one.
Yeah, I have to say, I strongly encourage people to use it. If you haven't tried Mythic, you should. I mean, you guys are, I have to say, you're, I mean, you know, you might not be at the size of channel, but you're fairly, I mean, you've been around for a while and you're a relatively known entity in the marketplace. One thing, you know, we like to ask everyone is, you know, these days you've been, and again, this goes back, you've been around since the old days. What is it like nowadays? I mean, you know, how's the market for a brick and mortar and an online store? And again, you're considered you may not be a huge entity, but you're a larger mid-sized entity. You know, is it tough? Is it a lot harder these days? Is business so great that it's not too bad? And, you know, I always like to ask people, is the dream still attainable? You know, can you still start your brick and mortar and, you know, end up being like yourself, you know, have a successful business that thrives for years? Is the marketplace still in that position?
That was like six questions there. You know that, right?
I know. I'm sorry.
All right. So opening a local brick and mortar store. The biggest advice I could give for that is, yes, it's still possible, but you have to do it correctly. There's a term that's used in the industry called clubhouse. That's to describe a game store that opens, that's really light on inventory and a lot, lot of times that's a person who began their career as a backpack dealer and they moved to a retail space with just the contents of what was in their backpack. While it's certainly possible to do that, it's extraordinarily tough. So my biggest advice for somebody who would want to open their own game store is you have to have the money to do it. There are many studies out there and people throw around the catchphrase all the time that most small businesses fail in the first year. And that failure is always due to undercapitalization. To open a real game store and do it correctly, you got to have money for a board game section. You got to have money for a miniatures game section and some role-playing books and lots of accessories. You know, I think we probably sell more sleeves and deck boxes and that kind of stuff that are just add-on kind of impulse buys than anything else. Those are the kind of things you need to have a successful game store. Dice sets, you know, things that aren't sexy, but they just grind at a continuous pace. And I think a lot of people overlook that stuff. What was the other question?
You know, so now you're a mid-size vendor in the space. How is the marketplace these days? Obviously it's getting more competitive, but is it harder or is there still lots of opportunity? If you make it past that first 4 years, does it get easier? If that makes sense, in the sense of, once you've grown the business, like, you know, the marketplace is still very, very good right now for, you know, a brick and mortar and online entity.
I believe that the market is strong. There's a lot of internet doom and gloom about the future of magic. And I think that's just folks just looking for something to complain about. I mean, I see more and more magic players every single day. The market is growing. As far as being an online vendor, one thing that's changed over the last, say, 5 years was the removal of the old school Pro Tour qualifiers, where each state would get one or two or possibly three of those events every season. Those were kind of like entry level vendor opportunities. You could get a table at a local PTQ for something like, you know, some of them were a couple $100. Some of them in, you know, big cities were, you know, $800 or $1,000 for a day. And that was a good intermediate step when you first kind of branch out from being a local store. Now with those removed, pretty much your only opportunity to go vend and buy cards somewhere else is Grand Prix and some of the city open events. And, you know, the cost to attend those events is big. It's not something you can move out of your basement and just go to. I think for 2018, I think the minimum cost to get a booth at a Grand Prix is something like $6,000 with travel expenses and some hotel rooms and paying a couple guys, your cost to go could be at least, you know, 8 or 9 potentially. You got to have a serious bankroll to be able to buy enough cards at that event to offset the cost of going. So I think you're going to see a further separation between, and I'll use the term the haves and the have-nots to kind of distinguish between companies that have the resources to do the Grand Prix circuit and those that don't. You know, personally, we just kind of gave up on that path because I realized in the game industry, there were just, you know, so many other opportunities that were lower hanging fruit than committing money, you know, for multiple events as well. You know, it's not just $6,000 or $8,000 for one event. They expect you to commit to multiple Grand Prix. So the money tied up ahead of time for booth fees and stuff, I just felt it was better invested elsewhere.
Interesting. So you made the comment that you see the market as being very, and that's very encouraging to hear. And it's also, I mean, that's an opinion that I also have, is that, I see a lot of doom and gloom, and I don't really understand where it's coming from, because, I do a lot of travel with QS, and all around the world, I see the game, thriving in places that people would be very surprised. I mean, I'm currently in Southeast Asia, and the game's doing quite well here. So it's always interesting to see here. I'm curious, and Chaz, you can kind of pick it up here. Obviously, QS is focused on quote unquote magic finance and people that like to buy and sell magic cards and invest, and small LGS owners, et cetera, even some mid-sized guys like yourself. And Chaz, you can kind of go into deeper in this, but what do you think about investing in magic? Is it the same as it was before? Obviously not. What ways do you think it's different? And do you still think it's a good investment vehicle?
I think it's still a good investment vehicle. However, the dynamics are probably different. I'm kind of struggling with this one. For us personally, we find that the best use of our resources and our capital is to just churn cards. We don't currently like buy 50 or 100 copies of a card, hoping that it spikes and then we go to sell them. Our business, we just have too many other things going on in our business to devote time to that. And it seems like, again, to reference the stock market, it seems too much like the penny stock thing where you buy 10 different stocks, hoping that one of them covers the loss for the other nine and that you end up somehow being a little bit ahead. The few times that I've tried to do the spec thing, I've failed miserably at it. So, there's some of that weighing on me.
We're gonna need to hear at least one of those stories before the end of the cast.
All right, okay, I'll have to remember the card.
You're coming from as a mid-sized vendor, but we also, Tark and I have also kind of, for the last at least year now that Tark and I have been doing this and having vendors on like yourself. I mean, even individual folks that either do this as a side hustle or they have, they're, pretty small, but they kind of deal in a little bit as well, sealed product or what have you, or have an eBay store or something like that. Tark and I have also been kind of adopting that model of, it's just not feasible to use a method like that anymore, where even on a smaller scale, and I love penny stocks. I mean, I still do it, but it's just easier to just be buying and selling and making transactions because, that's kind of where it is now with everything going on with all these releases and the timing of releases and all these sealed products and reprints. It's just holding on to like 100 of a certain card is just, it's not as safe as it used to be. So I can kind of understand where a lot of vendors are coming to that conclusion, but would you even recommend that for even the smaller kind of folks that invest into this game?
I personally, like I said, I don't follow any of those strategies. That's right. Not to say that it can't be done. I would say if somebody did want to do it, that they should do the stock thing. Pick 8 or 10 cards that you think are worthy of scrutiny and study, and then just start watching those 8 or 10 cards and buy them at the right time and sell them at the right time. It's certainly possible to spot patterns if you're willing to do the research. And again, I would point to the removal of the old school PTQs as another lost opportunity, because it used to be if, the season coming up in the fourth quarter was going to be modern, you knew to stock up on modern cards over the summer because you'd sell them in the fourth quarter. And, that opportunity is now gone again. So it's certainly possible, but not for us because it's just a time sink.
Understandable. I know I brought up reprints in that kind of dialogue right there. So I guess I'll just ask the question. What do you think of the kind of aggressive reprint policy? How is that, how do you look at that as a vendor?
We treat our cards as widgets. So the fact that they're doing a bunch of reprints really doesn't affect us much. The only thing that we really have to watch for is with the Iconic Masters set coming up when they were spoiling those cards. You know, you certainly don't want to be buying up mana drains at the pre-announcement buy price. You know, I don't know if an original Legends mana drain is going to fall much in price because there's a reprint with different artwork or not, but you at least need to allow some time for that market to shake out before you make that decision. So the reprint policy, I think it's good. I'm one of those people who believe that we should get rid of the reserve list. I think.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, so this is interesting. So I don't think we've had a conversation with a vendor who believed it, who had a like a firm stance on the belief that it should be abolished. Do you mind if can we go into that a little bit? I'm sorry, I don't want to derail it too much, but I'm very, very curious because I really don't think we've had any vendor that's been like, I really think we should get rid of the reserve.
Okay, so let me preface this by saying in no way do I wish financial loss on anybody who's tied their business to the reserve list. You know, a lot of these guys are my friends and I don't wish any ill will towards them. If they've had the money to bank up a bunch of reserve list cards, you know, that's a good choice on their part. I don't wish them any harm at all. But I think ultimately the reserve list is a relic from a past time. I was in business when they printed Chronicles, and I remember, if I could tell a quick story, I remember watching two guys trade cards at a table, and this was, again, in the days of Scry magazine. On one side of the table was a mock Sapphire. On the other side of the table was two or three Elder Dragon Legends from original Legends. And I'm listening to these guys do the negotiate thing. And finally, the guy with the three Elder Dragon Legends says, you know what? That Mock Sapphire isn't enough. You're going to have to throw something else in. So
That's amazing.
Back prior to the printing of Chronicles, Elder Dragon Legends were like this mythical thing that everyone knew they existed, but you hardly ever saw one. And they were just hard to come by. And Chronicles got printed. And keep in mind that this was back in the day that Wizards did not do spoiler season. You didn't know what was going to be in the cards until you bought packs and started opening them.
Yeah.
So Chronicles came out and people were opening a box. And at the end of their box, they had like three or four copies of Elder Dragon Legends. So these cards, like overnight, went from, you know, being worth $50 or $60 a piece down to $3 or $4. And this kind of shook the foundation of the whole Magic market. And I think Wizards realized that the secondary market, while they don't acknowledge it or say they have anything to do with it, they realized that the secondary market is what drives their primary sales of packs. No one's going to buy booster packs at a couple dollars a piece if you're going to get 15 cards that are all worth a penny. So they knew this, and they decided the best way to protect the secondary market was to create this reserve list. And I just think it's a relic from an ancient time, and it certainly could be revisited. You know, I know that there is... the term promissory estoppel gets thrown around a lot, and I'm certainly not a lawyer, and I can't speak to whether or not that's valid or not. But overall, I think Magic might be a better game and a better community if they got rid of the reserve list and, you know, did a controlled reprinting of a bunch of those cards. I mean, people are always screaming that they want Legacy to be supported, yet to build any deck, you need, you know, I don't know, thousands of dollars of staples to play your first game. It's just unrealistic to expect new people to get into the game when that's the cost to get in. That's, you know, removing the reserve list would give them the ability to reprint some of those really high value legacy cards. And ultimately, you know, my argument would be rather than selling, you know, one candelabra of Tonos for $1,000 or whatever it is, you would just sell a whole bunch of other cards that go in that deck and probably still make the same money. But, you know, I don't know if that's going to happen. Probably not.
I mean, but okay. But don't you think that the game is moving away from collectability as it is? And I mean, that's pretty much the, in my opinion, that's kind of the last bastion of true collectability in Magic. They reprint everything to the ground these days. I mean, that's just a fact. Nothing, you can't count on anything not being reprinted if it's not on the reserve list. And I feel like particularly Power and the Vintage cards, I mean, that's sort of like, that's the last thing for, if someone just wants to be a hardcore collector, that's kind of like the holy grail. Don't you feel like if you get rid of that, you kind of, I mean, the game as a collectible kind of, it sort of loses its credibility, don't you think?
No, I don't think it loses its credibility. I'm kind of dancing around this one. Well, I know I'm on the other side of popular opinion, and I hope I don't offend anybody, but
No. I'm bringing this up because we've never had that. I've actually never had this kind of conversation with a vendor, so it's a really interesting conversation to have.
And I mean, I'll certainly speak for my bias as well. I don't have a big stock of reserve list cards that I'm sitting on. I've just never chased those. So, right. Of course, I'm biased in the respect that it doesn't really affect me either way. I'm sure if I had many thousands of dollars of dual lands and power cards in a lockbox somewhere, I'd probably feel otherwise. I believe somehow, some way in 10 years, I don't think all those vintage cards that are worth so much money are still going to be worth that much money.
Really?
Whether it be through, graded cards are probably the future of investment. The Chinese fakes of those power cards are getting better and better and harder to distinguish. So, you know, I think for those collectibles to truly go sky high in price, they have to do something about the potential for it to be a fake. You know, every year the Chinese cards get better and better at passing for real cards. And nobody wants to pay thousands and thousands of dollars for a Black Lotus only to find out that it's not real. So people have to trust in the market for it to continue to go up. And if they don't trust in the market, you know, what's going to happen? You'll have, you know, cards that get locked in at a certain value that just aren't moving at that value. Is it still worth it or not? You know, I don't have the answer to that.
What do you think, Chaz? You got caught up in you sort of got involved recently or the past year. What do you think?
I'm kind of with Mark on this one. I mean, it's hard to say with this past year of and all this craziness that we saw, and it's becoming kind of an annual thing now that folks kind of realize the reserve list is still you know, a thing, and pretty much any of the cards on there, whether they're good cards or not, should be treated differently than the everyday, you know, bulk rare. And I get that. And that does make sense to me. But there is a kind of a threshold as to what Mark was saying, that they do still have to have, you know, meaning, and they have to still be desirable in some sense. Like, I just don't know at what point does these true collectors, you know, maybe some will, but I'm assuming many don't, aren't going to pay, you know, $15 for some obscure reserve list card just for no reason. So, you know, there is that kind of dynamic there that, while I agree that, like, a reserve list card, even if it's bad, quote unquote, should probably have a higher floor than the everyday overly printed, you know, bulk rare from, you know, Kaladesh.
But you don't know, do you have a position on whether you think they should get rid of it?
I do think it should be gone. I think the game would be better if the reserve list is gone. And I've had that position for a while now. Okay. I think even for me, and for individuals and especially vendors, I would rather sell $10, $150, you know, underground Seas than one $500. You know, I just think it would overall be easier to sell these cards because there's more accessibility to them. And, you know, I'm just using dual lands as an example. I don't know if you could chime, you know, you want to chime in after this, Mark, but I mean, they have so many more functions than just Legacy these days. I mean, back then, you know, it was all about, yeah, Legacy and Vintage and whatnot, but Commander and Casual has been, it pretty much picked up the heavy lifting of where Magic is going and probably saved Magic in terms of, you know, there's always going to be this section of players that are going to play this kind of version of Magic. So I just think they would have a, you know, I just think it would be a better game, and I think it would be easier and a boon to the secondary market if the reserve list was gone, rather.
I pretty much agree with that whole statement.
Yeah. I mean,
Here's, again, I go back to the collectability aspect. My problem with it is, my problem with this notion of getting rid of the reserve list is that I believe it really, really erodes WotC's credibility at a fairly deep level for guys like us. And even, I mean, Chaz, you've been playing for a while. Like, in my opinion, I would be like, wow, okay, well, I don't know what WotC will literally do anything because, and oh, by the way, let me preface this by saying, I have no power. I don't have a lot of money sunk into this. I don't have a position. I own zero power. So I'm not biased in the sense that I'm vested, you know, I have a vested interest, but I've been playing the game since the old days. And yeah, I think it preserves that collectible aspect because I don't think Wizards cares about the collectible as a business. I think their business priorities have completely evolved and as they should have, and they don't really care about the collectible aspect of the game anymore. You know, they just reprint everything, which is totally fine. I think that's good. That's healthy. But I think the reserve list is this one area where, and you know, you can say, well, maybe they should, it's hard to pull certain cards off the reserve list because that kind of compromises things. But I think, look, that's just the one area that you leave for people that want to actually collect cards. You know, one day, I think it would be really sweet to own power. And I view it as artwork. I mean, do I want to own power because I want to play with it? Honestly, no. I have no interest in playing Vintage. I want to own power because of what it represents. You know, they're kind of relics of the game from the early days. And, you know, I think it's like a piece of art. I literally would frame, you know, a whole set of power and hold it like it was artwork because I think that's kind of what it is. I think that, you know, gaming, all this stuff was very new at that time, and that's what it represents. I just think getting rid of it completely just would annihilate that.
Yeah, I do get that. And you know, I was also kind of on record, and we actually talked about this with other vendors as well, that, you know, it doesn't matter either way. I do think the game would be better if it's gone, but I understand why it would stay. So for me, if, you know, it doesn't really matter. And I don't own any of the, like, I don't own power and, you know, Moxen and all this stuff anyway. So, but, you know, there is a precedent of those cards being reprinted and the originals not being affected. I mean, there's a reason why, you know, Beta Sarah Angel, or, you know, however old Sarah Angel is still like $35 or something like that, or however much it is now. I don't have it in front of me. And, you know, seventh edition, you know, Sarah Angel's like a quarter, you know, or 10 cents. So there is precedent that original printings of cards would still maintain their value.
It's fair.
So, like, I mean, the same thing.
I don't know if a Black Lotus is going to be.
I do think so. I mean, you know, Mark, you know, told us the story about Chronicles. I mean, Chronicles, even now, there's still a disparity. While, you know, some of them may have cooled off a little bit, but there is a huge disparity between a Legends Nicole Bolas and a Chronicles Nicole Bolas even today. So I think there is, you know, would they drop a little bit, maybe, but there is something to say about.
I really think. Yeah. I think the fire sell that would happen, I think, would be very catastrophic to that segment of the marketplace.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mark, what do you think?
Well, I don't.
Let's hear the vendor's thoughts on this. You guys, yeah, sure.
I don't have an answer for what would happen. You know, like you said, the sell off would be catastrophic. And I don't have an answer for that part of it. And it's due to that fear of the catastrophic sell-off that the reserve list will probably remain. It's just easier for Wizards to keep their promise at this point than to, you know, throw gas on the fire and see what happens. Personally, what I would like to see is just a kind of a modification of what the reserve list means and have them allow for reprints from the reserve list in some kind of limited printing style, like a From the Vault, or occasionally they would put a reserve list card in like a dual deck before they said they would quit doing that. Personally, my goal in the industry is to see Foil Black Lotus as the FNM promo card. That's what I'm shooting for.
That's amazing. That's the quote of the night. A foil FNM Black Lotus. That would be that would be pretty epic. I have to agree.
if you think about the math behind that, though, I don't know how many stores there are, but each local store would get something like 20 copies of that card, hopefully to give away as their FNM prize.
Yeah, hopefully.
But, you know, that would introduce.
There's a hopefully in there.
That's kind of sad, but it's true.
You know, there's that would be a way to introduce a controlled amount of reprints into the market. You know, would that tank the regular Black Lotus, or would it be something like a Judge Foil Force of Will, where the Judge Foil version is actually worth more than any other version that's out there?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, I don't think any of this would likely happen unless, you know, they really had to kind of pull this out of their hat. You know, this would probably indicate that Magic is not in a good spot.
Go ahead. Well, I was going to say, you know, I've been doing this for 22 years, and they still keep coming up with new mechanics and new things for cards, and I thought they would have run out of ideas many years ago. So, you know, I think they'll just keep coming up with new stuff.
So that kind of leads me into the next question, which is, you know, you being around for a while and the game continuing to evolve, what do you think? Do you have any thoughts on Magic Arena? Are you familiar at all with that, or have you thought about that much?
I am. I don't know. I think I'm a firm believer that the tabletop gaming experience is kind of unique in the respect that we put away the electronics and we just kind of talk to people. I know that's going to sound, you know, sappy and, you know, like I am the old man that I am. but, you know, I mean, I think a lot of people will play the arena thing, and it's certainly gonna, you know, have the potential to grow our market. But for me, there's no substitution for sitting at the table, hanging out with friends that you like to spend time with.
Yeah. I have also brought up that point when we've talked about Magic Arena and its possible effect on every aspect of Magic. And I don't think it's a danger to the paper aspect of the game. I mean, you're in the gaming business, Mark. I mean, you've had your experiences with Pokemon, the TCG, right? And, you know, their online presence and their, you know, their tabletop paper presence has coincided for quite some time now. So I do think they can both run, you know, concurrently successfully together. So I just think it creates more awareness for the game and more avenues for folks to get excited for the game and want to go play it on both aspects. While I think they could expand on Magic Arena in the future, and who knows, maybe there's like a Pro Tour played on the platform at some point, I don't think they completely abandon the paper aspect. I don't ever.
No, I agree. And paper Magic is different.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had an online, so the, you know, Card Hoarders CEO came on, and obviously that's his business, right? He is digital and that's his world. And his perspective was, you know, he was like, well, you know, he thinks that it could actually pose a threat to the paper market. And I just don't see, I don't see any way that the digital game could cannibalize their core business, right? I just don't see them doing that. I suppose it's not, I mean, anything's possible, but I don't see them cannibalizing their core. I just don't see that.
No, I think that's more internet doom and gloom that you're hearing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Internet's pretty good at doing that.
So, all right, Mark. So before we get one of your horror stories from speculating, because we got to get at least one. We touched on this briefly earlier, but you know, for someone who's like, hey, cool, like I want to start, you know, buying and selling Magic cards or trading, and I, you know, what would you advise them to do if someone wanted to get started, and not starting a brick and mortar, but if they just wanted to get into the financial side and the investment, the trading and buying and selling, what do you recommend?
As an entrepreneur, my best advice for almost everyone is sometimes the key to success is just the gumption to get off the couch and make something happen. So if that's what you want to do, don't procrastinate about it. Do what you got to do to get started and make a move today that will start you down that road. That's my best advice.
And if I could take it one step further, if someone said, well, I have $100, Mark, if I want to do this, I have no idea. What do you recommend I do? What's a tactic you can give them?
Boy, I you got me. you're going to spend $100 to make a card selling business. I would say start with standard. I mean, that's where the most players are. You know, think about, I would stay away from like the scarab god, because that's going to eat up a bunch of your money. You could probably only buy 3 or 4 of those to try to resell. The scarab god card is, you know, one of those cards where the margin is going to be really thin. I mean, most people are going to expect, you know, a 10% margin between the buy price and the sell price. I would say you want to look for things that every deck needs, but they're not expensive, which I guess if I had to pick something would probably be the reprints of the lands that are in standard right now.
Ah, okay.
Yep.
We got some targets. Great.
You can buy, you know, those lands, they're only going to be $3 or $4 a piece, but because they're so low value, you'll find players who just don't care about them, and they'll throw them in to make a trade for something else to happen. And then, you know, you find a guy before FNM that needs one of those lands to finish his deck, and, you know, you got $4 right there.
Yep.
Awesome. All right, so now a horror story, Mark. Can you recall one?
I got one card that I bought about 150 of, and I still own 150 of.
Oh.
That's going to be General Tazri from Oath of the Gatewatch.
Nice.
They're in the
vault, and I'm hoping something happens for you.
You know, I was
gonna check your buy list for Oath of the Gatewatch cards, and I guess I'm not now, Mark.
Yeah, no, not that one. I'm pretty cool on those.
I'm good. You
know? And I can't even offer any reason why I chose that card. It was probably, you know, on a whim or something. You know,
why not? What were you were you thinking, first of all, do you have a buy-in price for us?
Oh, I think I bought them for like, I don't know, 80 cents a piece or something like that.
Okay. You're just hoping for this to just maybe hit a few dollars at some point.
Oh, well, this was, I bought them when the set first came out, hoping that in 6 weeks they would, you know, I was hoping for some pro tour deck to use them, and that certainly didn't happen. So, you know, my intention
the reason why I'm laughing so hard at this is because you literally sound like some of my friends and people I talk to, literally like, all right, I'm going in on 100 copies of this because I think it's going to hit at the pro tour, and then it doesn't hit, and they're like, well, I guess I'm bulking these out.
Well, yeah, and you can't even sell them to get your money back.
I think you're still on track, Mark, but I think your 6 week timeline is probably close to like 6 years. Yeah. So you're on your way.
That's right.
oh man.
That's funny. Any kind of, we're kind of getting to that point, Tark, is there any, I know you kind of want to ask your kind of last question here.
Yeah, I wrap this up with one last question, Mark. It's kind of a multifaceted one, but I ask this to all our vendors, and that's, is Magic healthy? Is it growing? And is the future bright for the game?
Yes, I think Magic is healthy. I think it's growing slower than it has in the past, but still growing. And I think the future is bright. It's just going to be different than what we're used to.
Okay.
As a game store owner, we're used to four major releases a year. You know, you get a block every one set every 3 months or so. And we're used to a cycle where we have 3 months to kind of churn those cards before we move on to the next one. And this year and early part of next year, at least, Wizards has, you know, vastly increased the rate that they're releasing stuff. You know, I'm not sure when this podcast will air, but Iconic Masters tomorrow is right around the corner.
Yep.
So, you know, who knows what that set's going to do. I would say, as I look at the pre-order prices for boxes, I'm stunned at how low they are.
Wow.
For the cards that are in that set. You know, so
is that a subtle recommendation to maybe pick up a box or two if you can get them at a good cost basis, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, I don't understand why that set is so low right now. It must just be that they're releasing it at an inopportune time. I mean, the week before Thanksgiving. November is typically one of the slowest months of the year for retail game stores. I don't have an answer for why that is.
Huh.
But, I mean, I have a theory that, you know, people out there in the world just get caught up in the holiday thing, and big box stores start hammering their sale, and just kind of lose out to the big message of go spend your money on Christmas presents. So I kind of question why they would release a set like this at this time. As I look at pre-order prices, the retail on a box of Iconic Masters is $240 or so, and I can see them, you know, shipping included for $178. That's probably a deal.
Okay.
All right.
Awesome. All right, guys. Well, if you can find Iconic Masters low enough, then you might want to consider grabbing a box.
All right, Mark, where can they find you on the internet? Where's the best place to get a hold of you?
Well, our website, mythicmtg.com, is probably the best place, or through Facebook with Mythic MTG.
All right. Tark?
Yeah, I'm at @the_Tark, T-A-R-K, on Twitter. I help the guys out over the MTG Finance Central Facebook page. You can chat with me there, and always with QS. So hit me up here. Mark, this was awesome, man. Thank you so much. Chaz, where can they find you, buddy?
At ChazVMTG, the QS Insider Discord is probably the best way. Just DM me. You know, you can find all my articles and my content at Quiet Speculation. If you want to hear me twice a week, I'm also on the MTG Goldfish podcast. So yeah. Mark, thank you so much. This has been an awesome podcast. Thank you so much for your time.
Sure. It's been my pleasure.
Yep. This wraps up the vendor series for this round, guys. And Chaz and I will be back possibly with another guest next week, a non-vendor guest. And we'll be back to our old ways of shooting the finance. I'm not gonna say the explanation, but
All right,
Mark,
folks,
thank you so much for your time, man. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, awesome way to wrap up the vendor series. Thanks, Mark. We will talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
Take care, everyone.
Take care. Thank you.